So last week we ate collard greens and cornbread on the show. This week we're going to switch it up a little bit and go with a little more healthier route. And try some of these greens here I grew. We've got three different types here. I got them cut this morning, got them nice and cleaned up. So we've got tatsoi here, which is a type of spinach mustard. So when you hear the word spinach mustard, it just means it's a mustard, but the leaf kind of looks like a spinach. Okay, go ahead. No, you can go ahead. Don't wait on me. So this is tatsoi. Then we've got arugula right here. And then we've
got... Worm got a hold of that one.
We've got our Savannah mustard here, which is a little bit bigger. And you can cook this like traditional mustard or eat it as a salad. Now I brought us a little, so I made us a little dressing concoction here. And I know everybody's gonna ask how I made this. So real simple, take olive oil. I've got this balsamic vinegar that's got a little jalapeno flavor in it that's really good. And a little bit of lemon juice. If you got fresh lemon, that's even better. I didn't, so I grabbed this out of the fridge this morning. So those three things there I made is just a little nice light dressing. Let me drizzle that on there and we shall partake here.
Eating them just raw without the shell, this is the one, and you said this was a spinach type, and that stands to reason because it tastes more like spinach. It's the most bland of the three. When I say bland, I don't mean it don't have any flavor. But that arugula right there has got a little kick to it, and we knew that going into it. And the one on the other side of there, you can really take the, you can get a mustard flavor in that one real good.
So you think the tatsoi is the has the less...
Yes.
Lesser amount of bite than all three of them.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's try here. I'm going to go in the tatsoi first.
Yeah, I could see eating this by itself on a salad or whatnot. Now that there, I'd want to mix it with other greens to have a more well-rounded experience with it.
But that still, even though that's fairly mild, still a lot more flavor there.
Oh yeah, I
mean, than just say iceberg lettuce or something like that.
Oh sure, sure.
A lot of you market farmers grow that and make their own salad mixes. That one is in our premium greens mix. I grew just a bed of it by itself. Mm-hmm. A lot of market farmers will grow beds of that and then beds of other stuff, arugula, and mix them all together and make their own unique mix. Now the arugula here, which we know does have a little more bite to it, which some people enjoy, some people don't. The citrus and the lemon really kind of pings up the arugula flavor, really makes it pop. My wife and I like to make a fig and arugula pizza with feta cheese, and it's not a traditional pizza by any means, but you cut some figs in half, put some arugula on there and some feta cheese, and it is really, really good.
So if I was doing a standalone salad, I'd have to pick this one, but I would definitely want to have some arugula mixed in with it, but I wouldn't eat a salad by itself, just arugula. I think it's got a little too much.
I like it personally.
Has a little too much experience for me.
Now, I don't know, hold on, I might have to differ in opinion with you here. I think that Savannah mustard is a little milder than that. We just have different taste buds.
Yeah.
They're all three really good.
Yeah, and I would like, this would be my standalone, but if I had my choice, I'd rather have a little of that peppered in as the mix. And I think that would be the cat's meow.
Just a little bit of Savannah,
a little bit of mustard,
a little bit of arugula.
A little bit of arugula based with this.
Mm-hmm. And the good thing about it is these greens have really good flavor, so you ain't got to doctor them up a ton. That simple little olive oil, lemon, vinegar dressing is really all you need. There's plenty of flavor there. You don't have to try to, it's not like bland lettuce that you get at the steakhouse buffet where you got to put all this kind of stuff on it to make it taste good.
Yeah, that is good.
All right, I'm going to leave that there because I know how you are.
Mm-mm.
Let you snack on that. So, got those greens there, and you know, you can plant. I've got them growing, beds of them growing now. The frost did take a little hit on them, but they should come back And you can plant those things in spring, cut them 4 or 5 times, get a lot of groceries off a bed of these things.
Yeah, and if you just got a little raised bed, if you got a 4x4 raised bed or maybe a 4x8 at most, let me tell you something. You can densely plant these in there and you can have you a lot of greens. You can supply a family of 4 easily in a 4x8 bed with these 3 varieties just right here.
I tell you what else you can do. You can take one of the new bottom trays we got and you can plant them in there. And if it was you just had 2 folks that was eating one of them bottom trays, you could probably cut it once a week and have 2 or 3 nice salads a week from it. So that would be a good way to do it too. All right, what else we got going on? We survived, you all right?
Yeah.
We survived the cold spell and I rigged me up a nifty little cover or mini tunnel for my English peas. I have to show that on the video coming up, but it worked pretty well. Speaking of your garden, everybody's been asking, and we've been kind of delaying it a little bit. Everybody's been asking about the multiplying onions and the guinea nest onions. So you finally want to give an update here?
Yes, I do. I'm going to tell you what. Now, these babies are looking good. Now, my nest onions, onions are right here on the right, and these are my guinea onions right here.
You mean your multiplying onions?
Well, they're both multiplying onions. I'm gonna expand on this just a little bit. Both of these are multiplying onions. The ones on my right here is what we call the nest onions that I'm gonna name them Tom onions. And the ones on my left here is a guinea onion. Both of these are heirloom varieties. And this one, Mr. and Miss Wright from over in Alabama sent me these and I was really appreciative of it. And I got me a row of these in. And I got probably 3 rows of these in. Now, to be fair, these were planted after these, so you can tell the size difference there. Both of them are growing good. Both of them have a lot of vigor. I want you to look at the root system on these right here. Now, you really can't, I got rocks falling out of there everywhere. You really can't tell it, but this onion has got a different growth habit than this one does here, and I'll explain that a little bit. What we're going to see later on when these bulbs here start forming, and they will actually multiply more. You can see there's 2 there already. They will fan out and make several different bulbs, and it will be in a cluster.
Almost like a garlic clove?
Yeah, almost like that, but even more of a bigger cluster, and it's kind of open at the top. So they kind of just break apart down there. Now, this guinea onion is going to be a multiplying onion, but it is a bunching multiplying onion. So it's going to grow in a kind of a more of a tighter upright, and you can just kind of break them apart. So they are going to do different. As of right now, I'm really impressed. Looks like we got a great crop coming on, and looks really good now.
So these aren't through multiplying by any means?
Oh, no. They got a long ways to go. I mean, you could start eating them now. You can tell where we had on bugs. If you wanted to, you could start eating them there. You know, I'm waiting, trying to grow them out because I ain't got that many, and I'm just scared to death I'm going to lose any of them. And I hadn't yet, but I'm telling you, I'm babying them.
They seem to have a more, because I've got some green onions that are about the size of the individual ones in here. And these seem to have a more extensive root structure than a normal sweet onion.
That may have something to do with the farmer. I'm not sure, but it may have a little bit something to do with the grower there. But these things are going to be great. Now, you're talking about a sustainable crop. Once you get your seed stock, these right here, you can save them year to year. And if there's ever been anything that has been truly sustainable, it's these heirloom multiplying onions, because you could keep them in your family for generations and generations. Keep your seed stock and share them every year. And they're very, very vigorous. Now, what I do not know is how well they would grow up north. I just ain't got a clue. We may have to end up sending some off to test grow up there somewhere. But here in the South, so far, they're really kicking it.
That's going to be interesting to see how much seed stock you get and how that turns out.
Yep.
I brought a little something I wanted to brag on here. Looky there. That is a Rio Grande red cabbage. Now, I didn't weigh this one because I knew last time I weighed that cabbage and talked about it and bragged about it on the show, I could tell it hurt your feelings a little bit. Yeah. So I didn't want to do that this time. The weight is going to remain anonymous on this cabbage here, but we have been eating these, and I love me some red cabbage sauteed in a pan. I like it a little better. You gotta get that pan real hot and almost get the leaves to brown and caramelize a little bit. And we put a little bit of, similar to this jalapeno vinegar, my wife's got a raspberry flavored vinegar. And after we sauteed it down, we put some of that in there, and man, it was really, really good.
So evidently you didn't have a lot of worm pressure. Last week with that warm weather, I noticed my worms had come out and I had a little bit of a problem. I had to get up there and spank them a little bit.
Yeah, I've been on top of my stuff. I hadn't sprayed in a few weeks. And
they look really clean.
Yeah, they
are. A little on the small side, but a little really clean.
Yeah, they are. They're definitely clean, and they're holding well. And this Rio Grande, we introduced this variety or started carrying this variety. One of the main reasons was because a lot of research has shown this is one of the bigger red varieties out there. And this is certainly the biggest red cabbage I've ever grown. So those puppies right there are doing good and holding well. You want a cabbage that holds well, because when you grow three or four rows of cabbage like I'm prone to do, you can't eat all that at one time. You really can't even sell that much cabbage at one time.
Right.
So you need to be able to go out there and get it as you need it.
Yep. Well, everybody knows how well I love hot peppers.
Mm-hmm. That comment could come back and bite
you. Come back and get you. Well, I have acquired some ghost peppers, some ghost pepper seeds, and I was able to get my hands on just a few of them. And we have probably got them in packs of 10. So there's 10 seeds to the pack, just like you see right here.
Which is all a fellow would need, probably.
And we got less than 100 packs to last throughout the spring. So these things are going to go quick. So if you're interested in growing some ghost peppers, we have some. Now I'm going to give you a little bit. I had to do some research before I got into this. I'm going to give you a little background on some of these hot peppers. I got a friend of mine up in Piedmont, South Carolina. Tony's been growing hot peppers for a long time. I talked to Tony on the phone, and Tony says, you really got to be careful where you get your seeds from, because these things have been grown in people's backyards and things like that, and people have saved seeds, and the variety or the breeding has got bred down. And a lot of these ghost peppers and these other peppers that were so hot at one time have gotten bred down, and they're not what they used to be. So he said, you got to make sure you buy them from a good breeder to make sure you're getting seed, because it is a problem in the industry of a lot of these bad seeds floating around.
So what you're saying is, if you were to go on Amazon and buy some ghost pepper seeds from Joe Blow, you maybe not get a real true ghost pepper hot or heat level there that you would get with these seeds that have been really taken better care of.
Well, it's almost embarrassing what they sell these for on Amazon. They sell them, they're $1 or something, you can buy 20 seeds on Amazon, but you don't know what you're getting. And I can tell you the wholesale cost on a good seed is a lot more than that. Now, what are we selling these seeds for? 10 seeds?
10 seeds for $4.99.
$4.99, and that sounds expensive, and it is, I know, but let me tell you something. We got these seeds from a breeder up in South Carolina that has a great reputation, and I feel extremely good about these being the original ghost peppers. If I didn't, I wouldn't sell them.
And to be a ghost pepper, it's got to register at 1 million Scoville units.
Over a million.
Over a million.
Over a million Scovilles, which in layman's terms is hot. So that's what we got. We ain't got many. I'm going to plant probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 of them.
You going to plant 50?
I don't know if I'll plant. Yeah, I may plant 50. I think I am going to plant 50. Huh. I'm going to sell some plants locally.
Okay.
Because I think I can make a little money selling some plants locally. They are tricky to germinate. These things can take a long time to germinate. They can take anywhere up to 4 to 5 weeks to germinate. And that's, you heard me right, 4 to 5 weeks. Now, they can come up sooner than that, ideal conditions. But these hot peppers are notorious for taking a long time to germinate and not being real easy to grow. So if you're a beginner gardener, never grown any before, this may not be for you. If you have confidence that you can do it, you know, it's definitely something unusual. And I mean, for 10 plants, for that kind of money, it's worth giving it a shot at. I'm going to grow some extra ones, try to sell them, and we may plant 2 or 3 in the garden.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We may have to try one on the show at some point. They have a really long maturity date. They take about 120 to 150 days from transplant. So be patient with it. I think I'm going to grow mine in a little container, a little pot there.
I may do the same thing.
That way, you know, I feel like this is going to be something I might need to baby a little bit more. And so I'm going to do that. few more updates before we get into today's main topic. We talked about the me going to the Deep South Homestead Gathering on March 21st. We've also got something else in the works with the Homesteaders of America Conference. And I'm not going to give away too many details, but we got something in the works there. And we could be making an appearance there. We'll announce more details with that as things get nailed down more concrete. Last thing I want to talk about, coming up on the end of January, we're going to have at least 20 more varieties added on the site. We'll have our potatoes in to be in ship. We'll have those Cherokee tans. So the end of January is going to be a very, very exciting time for us. And I want to talk about two of the varieties that are being added at the end of January, or some watermelons that I'm really excited about. But I've also got three others here. We're going to end up with close to, I think, about 10 different varieties of watermelons.
We should. We're in the watermelon capital of the world. We should be the watermelon people.
And every time I say that, watermelon capital of the world, we have somebody on the comments that challenges that belief. Just Google watermelon capital of the world and it will come up as Cordele, Georgia, which is about an hour down the road from here. So,
I am pretty much known as watermelon expert.
Watermelon king around
watermelon
here.
Watermelon expert.
So we've got, these are already on the site. We've got this one here called Baby Doll, which is a yellow watermelon. Then we've got this one here called Tender Sweet Orange, which, man, just makes your mouth water. An orange watermelon. And then we've got three that are what are called all sweet types. Now, Crimson Sweet is an all sweet as well, or in that same kind of vein. But these all sweet types are supposed to be even sweeter than the Crimson Sweet.
I don't know if I could take it.
So we've got one here, and all three of these have some good disease resistance. They're both resistant to anthracnose and fusarium. So we've got this Dolce Fantasia. And I'm no foreign language specialist, but I do know that means sweet fantasy. And then I've got two more coming at the end of January. One called Sangria, which just sounds like that's a perfect name for a watermelon.
Sangria, back in its day, was one of the staples on the commercial varieties a few years ago.
And then we've got one called Jamboree, which is an extra large jumbo elongated type. It's also an all sweet and supposed to do really well. You're going to have a hard time figuring out which one of these you're going to grow this year.
I am. And I'm leaning toward that sangria a little bit, but I don't know. We'll see.
We will see. Okay. So today's show, we want to talk about crop rotation. Can you put our snacks
over there? Let's not move them too far.
Well, I'll put them up there with you because I got to do some. I got some signs and stuff I got to show over here. Okay, so we're going to talk about crop rotation strategies. We talk about crop rotation a good bit, and you got to practice good crop rotation if you want to be successful in a garden, because if you don't, you're going to have recurring pest and disease problems year over year, and they're likely going to magnify or escalate even greater and greater every year.
Diminishing yield is what you would experience if you don't practice good crop rotation, because you're going to have a multitude of problems.
That's right. So in some areas of the country, it gets cold enough to kill fungal spores and insect eggs. Down here, it doesn't, especially not in a year like this year where we haven't had but one or two cold snaps. I fear it's going to be a bad year for bugs in the garden, or a tough year, I say that, coming this spring.
Well, you know, the Elliot Coleman that farms up in Maine talks about crop rotation a lot. So even up in these real northern states, it's very important.
Yeah. So you want to be able, not the goal here, and for different families, it can vary as far as the time you want to wait before you plant that family in that spot again. But the main takeaway here is you don't want to grow the same family of crops in the same spot in consecutive years.
Minimum, it should be 2 years.
Minimum 2 years. Some cases, more than that.
Yeah, a lot of people wait 6. You know, the Amish up in the Ohio, they're very good at this right here. at crop rotation. Sometimes they'll let land lay out as much as 6 years before they go out with the same variety.
You know,
or species.
Our buddies at Dixondale in South Texas, they do a 6 year fallow ground program. They do cantaloupes, and of course we know they do onions, and they have a 6 year rotation. So with the crop rotation, we've had a lot of people asking, is there a place online or somewhere I can find a list of all the crops that are in a certain family? And while I was trying to help these people, I kind of realized there wasn't. So I want to go through and just kind of give you a list of all the different major families that fall into the vegetables or encompass the vegetables we plant, what crops are in those families, and so you know, okay, don't plant this and this in the same spot in just consecutive years. So let's go through them. And I've got kind of the common name and the scientific name for the Latin nerds out there. So the first one, we've got one of our most famous plant families. We've got the nightshades or the Solanaceae. And this includes tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant, which most people know that those three are closely related, but also potatoes. A lot of people don't realize that potatoes and tomatoes are in the same family, so you don't want to dig your potatoes and then come behind that with tomatoes. You can have some issues, especially some blight issues. So those four are what we call our nightshades. When we say nightshades, that's what we're talking about. The next one, and this is a biggie when it comes to fungal diseases, are our cucurbits. Okay, and this is in the family Cucurbitaceae. So this is all your squashes. All these seeds look pretty much similar, so you know if it's a cucurbit just by looking at the seeds a lot of times. But your summer squash, winter squash, / pumpkins, cucumbers, watermelons, which we just talked about, cantaloupes,
gourds.
All these cats here, you're going to be susceptible to obviously squash bugs, vine borers, powdery mildew, downy mildew, and those spores can overwinter in your soil. And if you grow these 2 years in a row, I can promise you it's going to be worse the second year than the first.
Yeah, we have a lot of people talk about squash bugs, and squash bugs can be controlled a lot by two simple things. When that plant gets through production, gets out of the ground in good crop rotation.
Yeah, don't hang on for those last few squash when that disease and them squash bugs, because all you got is just a bunch of adults there laying eggs.
Taj Mahal for them.
Yeah, Taj Mahal. Get them plants out of there, don't compost them, burn them. Because, and I've had a lot of people ask this, why don't y'all take a lot of your plants, especially tomatoes and squash, and put them in a compost pile? If you can get a compost pile hot enough to kill those things, go for it. In a home garden situation, it's hard to get a compost pile hot enough to kill those fungal spores and those insect eggs.
Yep.
I don't have the means to do it. If you can, you know, definitely compost them, but most people can't get it hot enough to kill those things. This one, which is all what we've been eating now and what we've got started in the greenhouse, are our brassicas. And this one, as far as what people grow in the vegetable garden, this one probably contains the most crops. This is the one I have to be most careful with, is my brassicas, because there's so many brassicas I grow. I grow all these here, and I have to be careful with my rotation with them to make sure I'm just not brassicaing the fire out of a spot.
One of the biggest problems we have as far as insect goes on brassicas is flea beetles. Good crop rotation could also bust that cycle and help you control those.
Aphids as well.
Flea beetles, to me, is a little more problematic than aphids are.
So brassicas are in the family Brassicaceae, and that's going to include your mustard, like we talked about earlier, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kohlrabi.
Did you say kohlrabi?
Kohlrabi. Oh, that's sneaky.
Look at that one I grew in my garden. That's what they call a number one.
That is pretty. Now, that is uniform.
Look at my hand there, folks. That's a big one, ain't it?
That's a nice one.
Move ahead. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, sneak that in.
Yeah, I did.
My cabbage brag earlier, didn't you? Kohlrabi, bok choy, rutabagas, turnips, radish, all in the same family. So don't plant these behind one another. The next one is something I went a little overboard with this year. which I'm known to do, are the alliums, which are in the family Alliodiae. And this is our onions, shallot, garlic, leek, scallions, and chives.
I didn't realize chives was in there.
So all these pretty much look the same. You can tell an allium, you can smell an allium when you see one. You know what alliums are. These are all heavy feeders. Now down here, we don't have a ton of disease and insect issues with these things, but we still like to practice good crop rotation with them. Speaking of the alliums, this is another reason why you want to practice good crop rotation. Certain families, specifically like this allium family, these heavy feeders, they're going to suck your soil dry of nutrients just because they're such heavy feeders. So, you know, when you want to plan your garden rotation, you don't want to follow a heavy feeder with a heavy feeder. I'm not going to ever plant corn behind onions just because I would have to input so much nitrogen to make up for what those onions.
Now, blight can be an issue with this family here. Crop rotation helps with that. So we haven't ever experienced a severe outbreak of blight, but it can be an issue with these.
Okay. Moving along, we've got our legumes here in the family Leguminosae. And most people know what legumes are. These are nitrogen-fixing crops. Most of these all look the same. We've got our beans, our English peas, our field peas, our peanuts. Clover is a legume. And then, of course, winter peas are a legume as well. And then sun hemp is a legume.
And vetch as well.
I forgot to add vetch is there. So those are our legumes. And then this one is probably one that a lot of people haven't heard of before. So these are the umbellifers in the family Umbelliferae. And these, when you think about all these, the foliage on all these kind of looks the same. Your carrots, your parsnips, your celery, your parsley, your cilantro, your dill. So a lot of herbs in this family. And then our carrots, they all kind of have that really kind of dense, feathery looking foliage. So you don't want to follow any of these behind one another. And this one's not too hard. Because the only one out of here I grow in huge quantities are the carrots. I just make sure I don't follow carrots with carrots. It's not a huge problem, but good to know.
I like to grow a little cilantro in the springtime, but I don't grow much. In fact, to be honest with you, the last couple of years, I grew as much as I need to in a flat. It doesn't take a lot of cilantro, and it grows quick, and it's quick to bolt.
Yeah, you can almost take that cilantro and just put it in a, step it up to a 4-inch pot and have what you need.
However, I do like it. It's one of my favorite herbs.
I can eat a lot of it. The next one are the amaranths. And we know amaranths can be problematic in the weed category, but in the broad Amaranthaceae family, we've got beets, we've got chard, and we've got spinach.
Pigweed.
We've got pigweed as well. And we can't really help with our crop rotation when it comes to pigweed, because it's going to be there regardless.
Yeah, but there are some crops that will help with pigweed. And I'll tell you one right off the top of my head, corn. Corn does a good job of shading out pigweed.
Yeah.
So crop rotation, not as much as it does with insect and disease control, but it also can benefit with weed control.
I'll tell you another thing. If you got your ground right and you grow you a good, healthy crop of summer squash early, and you get some nice bushy plants, you won't have really a whole lot of pigweed.
Right, that'll do as well as shade some of it out.
Okay, two more I got.
Whew.
We got the grasses here, and the main reason to mention this is the corn. So corn is in its own family with some of these other grasses and stuff. Wheat, barley, oats, sorghum, sedan grass, sugar cane, and millet.
All those are classified as monocots.
Yes, all these are monocots. And that's why if we plant corn in a spot, we try to come behind it with a dicot cover crop instead of a monocot cover crop.
One of those that's a little iffy there, we think of buckwheat as a monocot, but it's actually a dicot. So you could follow buckwheat with corn. Would be a pretty good rotation there.
Or sun hemp.
Or sun hemp either one,
corn.
Yeah.
And then your dicots, most of your other stuff that you're planting, not corn, that's good to follow them with your sorghum, sedan grass, or your millet.
Right. Corn is a great crop, and we all love to grow corn, but it works great in our crop rotation because it has attributes, things that a lot of our other plants can't do.
Right. Last one here, and there's only one crop in here most people grow. This is the mallow family, the Malvaceae family. This contains okra and cotton and, of course, hibiscus as well. If you ever look at the flowers on all three of them, they look almost identical. So okra is something you really don't have to worry about. You can pretty much rotate it in anywhere. Just don't grow okra in the same spot year over year. Okra is a great crop to follow a heavy feeder because it doesn't need, or you don't want okra to be real nitrogen rich because you're just going to get a lot of foliage. So if, and I've made this mistake before, if you plant okra in a spot that you've got some very, very nutrient rich soils, you're going to get a lot of plant, not a lot of okra.
However, okra is susceptible to nematodes. So rotating that okra helps with your nematode control on okra.
All right. So if you have any more questions about crop rotation, like I said, our general rule is 2 years. So just don't plant any of those in the same family in consecutive years, and that should do well for you.
So I wrote down just a little something, simplify it just a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
So this is, you know, this thing could get really complicated, and it takes a little planning to be able to do it. You got to be able to write down what you did and kind of keep up where you planted what and that kind of thing. So to make it real simple, this is, and you can finesse this thing to make it work with you anyway, but this is one thing you could do. Legumes followed by a monocot, which is your corn. Let's just say legumes, corn, then with your root crops, and then with your leaf crops, and then with your fruit crops, and you could just kind of keep it rotating around. Now, if you got a spot there that you don't need to grow something, always throw you a cover crop in there to fill in the gap.
Right, so you've got, okay, so let's give an example of this based on what you got written there. Say let's start, you start off with English peas. Okay, you follow that with corn.
Right.
You follow that with
onions.
Onions. Then you follow that with a brassica like collards. And then you follow that with something like tomatoes. That's just a general example of how you would want to do it.
Right.
And like you mentioned, now the cover crops, and this is one of the main reasons I like using cover crops. Cover cropping does help you be able to tighten that rotation schedule a little bit. It kind of goes in there and refreshes everything.
And it fills in the gaps.
Fills in the gaps and refreshes everything and doesn't make it so I have to wait so long before I plant that crop there again.
Ryegrass is known as the cleaner of the soil. So ryegrass has attributes to it that takes disease away and it really cleans the soil. So if you have a situation where you're having a lot of disease, you definitely want to work ryegrass as a cover crop into prior to planting that. Example of that would be blight on tomatoes and peppers.
Okay, good deal. Is that all you wanted to share?
That's all I got.
Okay. So if you have any more questions about crop rotation or plants that are in the same family, put those in the comments below, and we'll be glad to answer them on next week's show. We've got a few questions from last week's show, and if we answer your question on the show, as always, send us an email to cusserve@hosstools.com, and we'll be glad to send you a nice surprise.
We're going to share. I didn't get the question memo.
Okay. So quick, go ahead.
Tammy Ziegler, which is a good friend of ours, came by here a while back and visited with us. She says, great show. Excited to hear Travis and his wife will be at Danny and Wanda's gathering. Can you all share your seed starting schedule with us?
Sure. So I sent this out on our email newsletter last week. And if you're not on our email newsletter, you can go to our website and get on that. Lots of good information. And that's the quickest way to get updated on new stuff. Anyway, so here's what I shared, and you can debate this if you want, but this is my general. Now, sometimes I get behind, but if in an ideal situation, this is when I would like to start seeds. We are zone 8B, okay? So let me go through this, and then I'll tell you how to adjust this based on your zone. So right now, we've got early spring crops going. So right now is the time, if you're in our zone, to have your cabbage, your cauliflower, your broccoli, your lettuce, your bok choy, your rutabagas, all that stuff going. Now's the time to plant those. In late January / early February, when we're gonna start peppers. Some of the commercial guys are probably have around here probably already started them.
But borderline, yes, right here at it.
So late January, early February, we'll start peppers. They take a little longer than most things we grow out. And those we don't plant Everything else we plant directly from the 162 trays. Peppers we step up to 3-inch pots, so we need a little more time with them. Mid-February, tomatoes and eggplants, and we can plant those straight from the 162 trays. They'll grow out in 4 or 5 weeks, usually pretty easily. And then late February, and some of these things people might say, well, I don't transplant those. And you don't have to transplant these, but it does allow you to get a jump on the growing season. And if you live in a cool climate where you have a short growing season, you definitely want to transplant these. And those would be okra, watermelons, pumpkins, zinnias, and sunflowers.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is if you're not in a big hurry to get okra, hold off on that a couple more weeks. They do not like cool soils as far as germinating. Even if you get them germinated and get them up in the greenhouse, they just don't seem to grow as well in those real cool nights. So if there was one thing you was going to hold off there and you didn't have room for, or you was a little too busy, hold off on your okra till it gets a little bit warmer and put it in.
With the okra, there's not a lot of disease problems or insect problems, so you can wait on the okra. The pumpkins and the watermelons, yeah. For us, it's important to get those in as soon as we can.
And bragging rights. Man, you got the first watermelons around. Yeah,
that's right. That's
I always talk to my buddies. I tell them, I said, my watermelon's big as softballs. And the next week, I tell them, I said, big as a volleyball, you know, that kind of thing. I give them an update.
Yeah. Yeah. So how would you adjust this? So this is the way I would do it. Okay, if you're in zone 8A, you're gonna jump forward a week. If you're in zone 7B, jump forward 2 weeks. If you're in zone 7A, jump forward 3 weeks. And you can kind of adjust that based on where you're at. But I'd say between the A and the B, each zone from 7 to 8, you're usually looking at a 2-week difference. From A to B, probably a 1-week difference. What do you think?
Yeah, you failed to mention potatoes. I know we don't grow potatoes in the greenhouse, but it's potato planting time
before long. It is getting potato planting time.
And if you ain't got your tato dirt ready, you need to get off that couch and start getting it ready.
That's right. All right, question number 2 we've got from Dennis Zimmerman. And he says, from year to year, do you clean your trays and bleach or anything for any diseases for new seedlings or another planting?
I do not. Not saying that you can't, but we do not. We don't ever have any problem with disease. Now, we do let our trays dry out before we use them again. So we'll get through using them. We'll empty them out and let them dry for a few days, few weeks before we use them again. You can use part solution and wash them. It's not going to hurt anything. The commercial guys actually use a heat and steam to take the disease and to sterilize their trays. But we've never had any issue. I don't think it's been. If you want to wash them with Dawn or a bleach solution, have at it. Makes you feel better. We just hadn't had that problem.
Now I will say this: I do practice a little bit of crop rotation with my trays. And we can do, if you just got one or two trays, obviously you can't do this, but we have about 15 trays we rotate through. And so if I just plant some lettuce out of a tray, I'll plant a brassica or beets in there. I try not to plant the same crop in that tray consecutively. Whether that makes you different or not, I don't know. It's just something that I kind of do.
And that tray, if it gets dry and stays dry for a very long time, it's going to take care of itself, because a lot of these pith in these rhizomes are water spores, so they can't live in that real dry environment. I'm up next. Okay. Rebecca Ozor.
I think that's Orozco.
Orozco 83 says, what is y'all's favorite tomato? Also was wondering if you've ever tried the egg and the hole trick. I've seen a lot of people doing that, but haven't tried it.
Okay, so question, first part, our favorite tomato. You can go back on some, was it last year on a Row by Row show, we did some taste tests. Our favorite overall taste-wise is the Sun Gold. That was as far as flavor, but it's a smaller one. As far as your bigger beefsteak tomato, the Bella Rosa seems to be our favorite. Really interested in trying that Red Snapper this year and seeing how it compares. I would say Bella Rosa, Brickyard, a tight, close second, is currently our favorite. But that's going to vary from zone to zone. I recommend trying several and finding which one you like. Egg in the hole. We grew up eating egg in the hole.
Yeah, boy.
If you don't know what an egg in the hole is, you take you a piece of light bread or white bread and you pinch out the middle of it, you throw it down on a hot skillet and crack an egg in that hole right there, and it's good eating, good quick breakfast, and we've been eating egg in the hole a long, long time.
I must have been 4 or 5 years old when I experienced my first egg in the hole.
And yeah, it's one of those things. Now, I will say it's been a while since I've eaten an egg in the hole, and I don't know that my kids have ever eaten an egg in the hole. But they're only, you know, two and 4 years old. But that's a good reminder there. I need to cook them one this weekend and see how they like it. Number four here is from David H. He says, when you move from the greenhouse to the pallets outside, are you putting them in full sun or shaded area?
Full sun. I never see the reason to put vegetables in part sun. I always go full sun. Part sun could cause some problems.
Unless it was 110 degrees outside or something, but you wouldn't really.
Well, even then, we always go in full sun.
Yeah.
So, full sun. And even if your vegetable garden, if you're planning on putting in a vegetable garden or you got a vegetable garden, you're having issues, full sun for your vegetable garden.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you all for giving us those questions. Send us that email so we can get you a little prize. And always put your questions in the comments. If you've got any ideas for new shows, show topics, anything like that, let us know. We appreciate you guys watching every week. If you enjoyed this week's show, give us a big like, hit that thumbs up button, and share it with your friends. Don't keep us a secret.
Yep, and don't forget to order your ghost peppers.
Ghost peppers and taters are going to run out.
Yep.
Get your taters if you haven't already, and we will see you guys next week.
Take care.